You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
I want to live again, and I want to look them straight in the eye, and I want to tell them what a cheap, lying, no-good, rotten, four-flushing, low-life, snake-licking, dirt-eating, inbred, overstuffed, ignorant, blood-sucking, dog-kissing, brainless...
Yeah, there's a lot of bad isms floating around this world, but one of the worst is commercial. Makeup, even in Brooklyn it's the same.
That thing had nine lives, she just spent them all.
Woo! I triple dog dare you!
I don't believe you're an angel. I think you're a demon right out of...
Oh, Henry, don't say that.
Does someone need a hug?
Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here.
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
Sentimental hogwash.
What was the last thing you and Charlie did before you went to bed Christmas Eve?
We shared a bowl of sugar, some shots of brown liquor, played with my shotguns, field dressed a cat, looked for women.
I'm the worst toy maker in the world. I'm a cotton-headed ninny muggins.
My mouth's bleeding, Bert! My mouth's bleeding! Doo-doo pedals! Doo-doo! There they are! Bert! What do you know about that? Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Hello, this is Jeff Westover, editor of MyMerryChristmas.com and chief eggnog chugger at the Merry Forums of My Merry Christmas, the internet's longest ongoing celebration of Christmas, now entering our 20th year. In this, the fifth episode of the Merry Podcast, we celebrate some of the best traditions of Christmas with a look at the ancient traditions of Santa Claus and adventures in gift-giving. Plus, Jeff Gould of A Prairie Christmas will share a little about Christmas on the farm, and we get a brand new update from the North Pole from new elf and famed newsman for Santa Claus, Rusty Bells. This podcast is brought to us by the good folks at PackageFromSanta.com, a longtime sponsor of My Merry Christmas and a big supporter of our charity at SantaSleigh.org. This is, of course, the time of year to be thinking Santa, and what better way to get your little one ready for Christmas than to receive their own package from Santa this year? Stop by PackageFromSanta.com and take a look at their many options, including this year a personalized video greeting from Santa just for your child. As you know, we are big believers in teaching kids about the goodness and veracity of Santa Claus. We value not only visits from Santa, but also understanding of the Santa legend, and teaching our kids about the real Santa Claus, and what a true hero he continues to be. We think nothing of our kids and their pretend of having superheroes like Spider-Man or Wonder Woman. Why not give them a real superhero to learn about? Perhaps you can have them listen to this legendary tale of Santa Claus. They say that every legend begins with a true story. This is that true story. It is a story that is very old, but it is a story that never gets old. The story explains a lot of why we do what we do at Christmas, and it needs to be told again and again. The legend you are about to hear is about a man you think you already know. He is, after all, everywhere this time of year. You see him in movies, on television, and in places where you shop and hold parties. We sing about him in songs and read about him in books. Many kids believe in him. Some do not. Many adults love him. Others not so much. How can you know? How can you find out? Where is the truth behind the legend of Santa Claus? The truth doesn't come from where we see him now. The truth won't be found in movies, songs, or in poems. The truth of him, the man, is the same as it is for all of us. It lies in where we come from. He was born long, long ago. He did not come from the North Pole, and he did not come from Finland. In fact, he was born so long ago that the place where he came from is no longer named the same as it was those many years ago. He was born in a tiny village in what we now call Turkey, a place not far away and at a time not long after Jesus Christ walked the earth. This is important to know, because he knew all about the Savior, and he believed in him. He was born of parents who loved him and who taught him all the stories of Jesus, of his miracles, his life, and his ministry. He was a happy boy, and his mother called him Nicholas. For the first 10 years of his life, he knew little sorrow. In fact, as the child of wealthy parents, Nicholas didn't need a thing in the world. His parents, while wealthy, loved him deeply, and he was very close to both his mother and his father. But then, as happens sometimes to people, Nicholas experienced some tragedy. When he was 10, both of his parents died of a terrible disease, leaving Nicholas alone in the world. Not knowing what to do, Nicholas turned to the one resource he had that he felt he could trust, Jesus Christ. He went to the church and explained to them there that he wanted to live a life worthy of being with his parents again. He believed that if he lived well, that God would grant him the love of his mother and his father again. Nicholas then grew up under the direction of loving men of the church, who taught him how to teach people and how to help them with their needs. Nicholas did have a good heart and relished the work given to him in the church. He was, in fact, so good and so obedient and so helpful that it was a surprise to everyone except those whom he served, when he became the youngest bishop ever in the history of the church at that time. Now, there is one thing about this story you need to understand. It happened a long, long time ago. It happened before there were telephones, before the internet, before television or newspapers or texting. Back in those days, a man would be considered lucky if he ever traveled 50 miles from where he was born, and the chances that a person could become famous around the world were almost impossible. And yet this boy, the orphan boy who became bishop, would, by the time he was grown, become world famous. By the time he was an adult, his story would be known and retold over and over again. People who never met him would name their children after him. Places where he had never visited would bear his name. In the old world, which is what we call the place and the time where he lived, more than 2,000 churches would bear his name, and countless stories about the good that he did would be told generation after generation. What did Nicholas do that made him so famous? Well, there are many stories. It is hard, as legends sometimes go, to know which of these stories are true, but there is one story about him that just feels right and rings true to anyone who has ever received an orange in the toe of their Christmas stocking on Christmas morning. As bishop, it was Nicholas's job, as it is for bishops everywhere now, to see to the needs of those who live around them. And there was, in the place where Nicholas was bishop, a poor man with 3 daughters. Remember that this was in the old world, a different time and a different place. Back then, if a person didn't have the money to get married by the time they were grown, they might, in very extreme circumstances, be sold into slavery to pay the debt to his parents for his upbringing. It was especially hard for a family to sell a daughter into slavery, and that is exactly what this poor man with three daughters was thinking that he would have to do as his eldest daughter was approaching the age to be married. Somehow Bishop Nicholas heard of this family's problem, and he wanted to do something about it. Now, the man who was the head of this family was a very proud man. He might be poor, but he and all in his house worked very hard. They had no need for charity. They believed in taking care of themselves. In fact, the man was so proud that he was afraid sometimes to show his face at church, lest the bishop would learn how tough his circumstances really were. Because of this man's pride, Nicholas knew he couldn't just visit the man and give him the money. No, if the man was to receive the gift, that he needed to save his daughter a life of misery, it would have to be given in such a way that the man would never know where it came from. In Nicholas's mind, the gift he needed to give was free. The man didn't need his pride to accept it because nothing was needed in return for the gift. The gift was a gift of love, much like the gift of the Savior. God so loved the world, Bishop Nicholas knew, that he gave his only begotten Son a tremendous gift given freely to all mankind. His gift of gold was nothing in comparison to that great gift of God, but it was symbolic of it. There was no way Bishop Nicholas was going to fail in giving such a gift. So in the dark of night, Nicholas put on his long red cloak, trimmed in white fur. That was what bishops wore back in those days. And he tucked in his long white beard, and he set off with his hand in his pocket around a small amount of gold. It wasn't much, but it was just enough to solve this family's problem. Now over time, as the story has been told, it has never been made clear if it was a bag of gold or a ball of gold. And it has never been made clear how it was delivered exactly. We just know that somehow the gold ended up in the toe of the stocking of the girl who would have been sold into slavery. Somehow Nicholas delivered the gift undetected. The man and his family were surprised and very, very happy at their change of fate. But who, they wondered, could have given them such a gift? The man thought about it a long time and could think of no one who would do such a selfless thing, but he vowed in his heart to always be grateful, and if he could, someday, in some way, he would express his gratitude for the gift if the opportunity ever presented itself. Now remember, this man had three daughters, and in a few years when his second daughter came of age and his situation had not improved, the family once again faced the problem. And as before, word of the man's plight reached the ears of Bishop Nicholas. So on another dark night, he donned his long red cloak with the white fur trim, and tucking in his long white beard, he set off to make an anonymous gift of just what was needed to solve the vexing problem. Again, he was successful, as before, and the family rejoiced at their good fortune. The father of the family, more grateful than ever, hit his knees in prayer to thank God that such a gift could be theirs. Twice the miracle had occurred, and it seemed too much to the man to go unacknowledged. He prayed to God that he might know who the silent gift bringer was. But remember, he had one more daughter coming of age, and though the family worked very hard over the next couple of years, they did not have the money to solve the issue for the third daughter either. The man knew that God would not allow the miracle to happen twice, only to see failure the third time around. He knew that someday, in the dark of night, an anonymous gift bringer would come. This time he vowed he would be ready, so that he could give thanks three times over for the generous gifts that had saved his children. So by night he kept watch, as he continued to work by day for his family. Bishop Nicholas knew this man's situation. He knew he had a third daughter, and he knew what he must do. So once again, in the dark of a cold winter's night, he donned the bright red cloak with the white fur trim, and he tucked in his long white beard, and he set off to deliver, one more time, a life-saving gift in secret. How did he get into the house? That has always been a mystery. Some have said he just left it on the porch, but others insist it always ended up in the house inside the stocking of the young girl who needed it so desperately. Some say he threw it through a window where it landed in the stocking, and one version of the story says he threw it way up high in the air, up towards the roof line of the house, where it went inside the chimney and down into the stocking below. Regardless of how it happened, the small ball of gold always ended up where it needed to be, inside that stocking. The man never said for sure how he saw it happen. He was too startled to see the bishop with the long white beard and the bright red cloak standing there in his home. As he fell to his knees to thank Bishop Nicholas for his gifts, the bishop swore him to secrecy and asked him not to do anything in return for the gifts of gold. But the man's happiness and gratitude knew no limits. He could not contain the secret of his good fortune, and he told all that he could about the dark night visits of Bishop Nicholas. Over time, the story and others like it spread. He became known to many people because of these stories. There was the story of the time he saved a city from starvation by the miracle of the grain. There was another story of the time he saved three children from being murdered by an evil innkeeper. He was known for protecting women, sailors, and for caring for the less fortunate. Such people were called saints in those days. He had a way of making things better for desperate people, and when people were in need, they would think of Saint Nicholas, no matter where they lived. The word saint in some languages is pronounced Santa, and the name Nicholas is sometimes twisted in a pronunciation of Claus. His name, translated in many languages, literally sounds like Santa Claus, and that, over time, is the name he has become known by. So on this Christmas morning, as you check the toe of your stocking, and if you find an orange, think of the bishop's gold, and what that anonymous gift symbolized then, and what it symbolizes now. Every gift, whether given or received, is a gift of love, no matter how great, no matter how small. That is the story behind the legend of Santa, a legend we celebrate this Christmas and every Christmas.
Christmas is the most anticipated time of the whole year. It's a time that has the most memories and nostalgia. A time that makes even the most world-weary pause and reflect at Christmas lights and Christmas smells of long ago. Cookies baking, the laughter of family, the delighted smiles of children. Many of us remember Christmas on the farm, whether that was the farm we grew up on or the farm we visited. There's a lot of great memories of Christmas on the prairie. Winter on the farm, though, of course, is tough. The chores are harder, the weather is harsher, but kids still find a way to play, even if they're adult children. Like Marv, who writes that his dad would pull kids through the snow-covered plowed fields behind the tractor. He would put them on a sheet of sheet metal, give them a rope to hold on to, pop the tractor in road gear, and using the wheel brakes, could whip them over frozen fields, all the time laughing like a demon. Or Rod, he was one of those lucky kids who grew up on a mile and a half long hill. And if he and his brothers were quick, they could work the whole run in about 20 minutes. This was important because their dad did not like or approve of them sliding. They would take their sleds and go all the way to the top of the hill, and then ride the icy road all the way down to the creek bottom. Take about 5 minutes. This is the days before roads were salted and sanded. Now, the reason their dad did not approve of sliding had to do with their boots. They were only given one pair of boots that had to last all winter long, and the only way you could make it down that icy, winding road was to drag the toe of your boot to make the corners. Or Roger, who said that as a child, toys were not what they had. But they did have family, and every Christmas they would make homemade ice cream, milk from cows, eggs from the chickens. They would chip ice out of the pond, and then to make it cool quicker, they would chip salt out of the salt block in the barn. Rod tells me they would play farm at night after chores were done, and they would use not toys, but what was on hand. They would take broken pieces of corn cob, and those were cattle. The fat pieces were the bulls, the narrow, the cows. And for pigs, they used acorns. Does this sound like a pathetic way to spend Christmas? Not to all the people who tell me their stories from the farm. They write and say that hard as it was, they enjoyed the life growing up in the farm, and nothing can compare to a fine winter's day and a sleigh ride.
It's getting close to Christmas, and there's still so much to do. Moms and dads, if your child would like to receive a personalized letter from yours truly, visit packagesfromsanta.com now. Every child deserves a special letter from Santa at Christmas time, but you have to hurry. We're ready for your visit now at the original personalized Santa letter website, packagesfromsanta.com. Merry Christmas!
This is breaking news from SantaUpdate.com.
Hello, world. Rusty Bells here, your radio voice of news from the North Pole, with another update of Santa Claus from the North Pole for SantaUpdate.com and Merry Christmas Radio. And now, it's time for the news from the North Pole. Dateline, November 27th, 2010. Santa Claus got things rolling at the North Pole on Operation Merry Christmas, his annual effort to deliver Christmas to believers all over the world. Even though Santa has been absent from the North Pole, he doesn't think it will affect his readiness to fly on Christmas Eve. But there's lots of things to get done. The sleigh isn't ready. The toys aren't made. The elves are confused, and the reindeer won't fly. But other than that, everything is under control. For more details of daily news from the North Pole, please visit SantaUpdate.com, the world's only source for tracking Santa from the North Pole itself, now in its 20th year. For Santa Claus and all at the North Pole, I'm Rusty Bells reporting.
This update has been brought to you by SantaUpdate.com, now in our 19th year of tracking Santa every day from Thanksgiving to Christmas, and every 15 minutes on Christmas Eve as Santa makes his way around the world.
Time now for adventures in gift-giving.
It began as a simple, thoughtful gift. Back in 1964, Larry Kunkel's mother thought he'd appreciate a nice new pair of moleskin pants. He didn't. Living in Minnesota, the pants were prone to stiffness in the freezing winter weather. So Larry pawned off the pants on his brother-in-law, Roy Collette, as a gift the very next Christmas. But Roy didn't care for them either, so he returned the favor and the pants the following Christmas. And thus the game began. Each year as Christmas approached, Larry and Roy contemplated those pants. For the giver, there was delight in knowing that possession of the pants would no longer be theirs for at least a year. For the receiver, it meant another Christmas morning of knowing exactly what one of the wrapped presents beneath the tree would contain. One year, as Roy looked forward to his turn as the giver, he took their merry game to a new level by tightly twisting the pants into a wrapping of a 3-foot-long, 1-inch-wide galvanized pipe. Perhaps Roy was merely trying to trick Larry into thinking that he was getting something new, or perhaps he was merely hoping to end the gag once and for all by making the pants impossible to give again. We may never know Roy's intentions, but we do know what happened as a result. The next morning, Christmas morning, Larry surely giggled at the picture of Roy struggling to untangle a 7-inch square bale of wire in which resided the infamous and unwanted pants. With a credit now to both of them in demonstrating ingenuity in the annual exchange of the gift, the stage was now set for their legendary Yuletide gift-giving exploits to grow to a more and more ridiculous level with each passing season. There were, however, some ground rules. They agreed, for example, that the pants could not be damaged in their packaging or delivery. They were duty-bound to use only legal and moral methods of wrapping. That meant one could suppose that wrapping the pants inside of a cadaver or booby-trapped to explosives was out of the question. Nevertheless, their schemes each year became more and more creative. Roy raised the stakes by placing the pants into a 2-foot-square shipping crate filled with stones and strapped shut with steel bands. Larry countered by mounting the pants inside of an insulated window and shipping them off to Roy complete with the 20-year warranty. Soon their annual gift-giving exploits began to attract attention. The United Press International first told their story in 1983 and updated the world on their next chapter each Christmas for years. One year, Roy stuffed the pants into a coffee can which he had soldered shut. Then he buried the can into a 5-gallon container of reinforced concrete. Larry responded by entombing the pants into a 225-pound steel ashtray made from 8-inch steel casings. He even personalized the unique gift by putting Roy's name on the side. Roy must have been so proud. How he retrieved the pants without burning them when he used the cutting torch remains a secret. Perhaps the work of cutting free the pants put Roy into an industrious mood. He next secured the pants into a 600-pound safe and then welded the door shut. Larry took one look at the safe and decided then and there to do Roy one better. He put the still nearly new pants into the glove box of a 1974 Gremlin. Then he had the car crushed into a 3-foot cube, placing a cheery note where to find the pants inside the automobile. This happy tradition seemed to get bigger and bigger each year. Roy once secured a huge used tire that once was housed on a piece of heavy construction equipment. It was 8 feet high and 2 feet wide. He filled it with 6,000 pounds of concrete after placing the pants inside and tagged the outside with the merry sentiment, "Have a good year." The next year, UPI gleefully reported that Larry wrapped the pants inside of a 17-foot red rocket ship that weighed 6 tons after being filled with concrete. Complicating matters was the fact that the ship contained 15 concrete-filled containers, only one of which actually contained the Christmas pants. Roy was undaunted. He devised a 4-ton Rubik's Cube constructed of kiln-baked concrete covered with 2,000 board feet of lumber. Following the puzzle theme, Larry returned the pants the following year inside of a station wagon filled with 170 steel generators, all welded together. Since the rules stipulated that the pants had to be retrieved undamaged, Roy faced several months of disassembly and just trying to find them. And so it continued until 1989, when the complexity of their wrapping finally damaged the pants and ended the well-documented game. Roy, working to wrap the pants in 10,000 pounds of jagged glass, inadvertently ruined the pants when molten glass being poured over the container holding it all burned them beyond recognition. Sadly, Roy put the ashes in an urn and sent Larry a final note. "Sorry, old man. Here lies the pants." An attempt to cast the pants in glass brought about the demise of the pants at last. 26 years and untold tons of material later, the legend of the Christmas pants only grows larger. Larry and Roy's exploits have been duplicated in measure by fun-loving folks from all over. The lesson learned seems to be one that is simple enough. These giving rituals are never really about the gift, or rather, the gift is never really what is inside the package. It is instead what is inside the heart. As we leave you now, we thank and acknowledge all the professional contributors to the Merry Podcast, all of which are listed on our website at mymerrychristmas.com. We hope especially that you'll take a look at iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Amazon for the work of outstanding musical artists we've featured here on the podcast, specifically John Schmidt, Paul Cardall, David Tulk, and Steve Warner, of whom we have really come to appreciate this season, not only for their artistry, but for their Christmas spirit as well. We appreciate as well our sponsor, PackageFromSanta.com, and their fine support. You can catch an expanded version of this podcast on our new show at Merry Christmas Radio, playing daily from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time with new release music of Christmas, music from the movies of Christmas, and Christmas comedy as My Merry Christmas goes on the airwaves at Merry Christmas Radio. Join us the week of Christmas for episode number 6 of the Merry Podcast when we talk about the excitement of tracking Santa and the 19-year history of following Santa on My Merry Christmas. We will explore Christmas trees and share more stories in the adventures of gift-giving, and hopefully we'll have a surprise or two worked up for the members of the Merry Forums. This is Jeff Westover of My Merry Christmas wishing you and yours, as always, a very Merry Christmas.